Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer portions of today's conference. To ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Lance Rakovian. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Julie. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lance Rakovian. I'm a communications specialist here at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I'm going to be helping out with today's meeting, facilitating, trying to make it effective for everyone. So I appreciate your assistance in that. The purpose of today's meeting is for NRC staff to update stakeholders on Project AIM activities, particularly common prioritization and rebaselining, since our September 1st, 2015 public meeting to solicit input from stakeholders on the agency's work. The input assisted the agency in evaluating what activities can be shed, performed with fewer resources, or performed with a different priority while still fulfilling its regulatory mission in a manner consistent with the NRC principles of good regulation and its organizational values. Our agenda today is fairly simple. We have a few presentations to start out on the comments we received when we solicited public comments and on the rebaselining, and also just really to bring you up to speed on what's been going on with this initiative. We'll then open the floor to questions. We do have a telephone bridge line that's in operation at this point, and we have Julie, our operator, helping us out. So once we get to the point where we'll open the floor to questions, we'll go ahead, give Julie an opportunity to set up a queue on the phone, and we'll take questions here in the room and on the phone as well. So for those of you in the room here, we just ask that you keep side conversations, noise levels, et cetera, minimal. If you have any electronic devices, if you could go ahead and put those on vibrate or silence. Again, just trying to make sure that those on the phone line and also in the room can make sure that they can follow along. For those of you on the phone lines, once we get to the point where we'll take Q's and A's, again, Julie will let you know how you can essentially raise your hand on the phone and so you can ask a question and she'll start a queue. We'll do our best to get to everybody. We've got a couple hours today, so hopefully that won't be a problem. For those of you here in the room, exit is out the room, take a right, and straight on. Restrooms are out the room, take a left, and around the corner. We do have copies of the slides over here. For those of you on the phone lines, the slides have been posted, so you can link directly to them from our public meeting schedule page on nrc.gov. So if you take a look at that, look for the public meeting schedule, find this meeting, and you should be able to link directly to them. We also have public meeting feedback forms over here on the table. For those of you in the room, you can grab one of those. For those of you on the phone, there should be a link directly again on the public meeting schedule page for this meeting. You should be able to click and provide your feedback directly. With that, I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to Fred Brown, who's the lead for Project AIM. I'll be back once we open the floor to Q&A. So, Fred, do you want to stand at the podium? Do you want the handheld? What would you like to do?
No, I think I'm good with a lapel.
You got the lapel? Okay.
Yeah. So, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out in the cold. I'm glad it's not as cold now as it was a couple mornings ago. So if we could go to the agenda slide, please. I'm going to start just actually by talking about a couple things you probably already know. Many of you were here in September. Then in the center, the heart of the presentation will be the things that you're interested in, and then close with next steps and opportunity for questions and comments, as Lance said. So I want to start with the Project AIM's tie, the definition, what Project AIM is to us. It's really about recognizing the changed environment that we're working in and responding to it in a smart, proactive way that continues to focus on our mission and achieving our mission in an effective and efficient manner. On the next slide, that mission, of course, is to protect public health and safety and protect the environment in the activities that we regulate. And one of the things that we focus on with both our staff and the public is a reminder that while there are changes in the industry and our workload is going down, there still is a lot of important work that we do. We need to be focused on doing the right part of that work in the right way. But while this is a big deal for us in the greater scheme of things. It doesn't represent a fundamental shift in the protection of the public and the environment in the areas of nuclear safety or nuclear security. So having said that as a way of preamble to put all the change that I'm going to talk about in context, we did announce to the public that we were doing these two activities, common prioritization and rebaselining, back in the summer, and we had a public meeting on September 1st, and again, I recognize many faces and thank you for your continuity in this process. We had a window for public comment for those that couldn't participate in the public meeting. We did capture all of the suggestions and comments from the public meeting, and we also captured all the suggestions and comments that were provided in writing or by email to us. And those all should be publicly available in ADAMS if anyone has interest in going back and looking at those. In parallel with obtaining comments from external stakeholders and the public, we also solicited internally from our staff for things that they know that we do that they felt could be done more effectively to help with our efficiency and to reduce our costs. We had a fair amount of participation on the part of staff. In total, we had over 400 comments and suggestions that were collected and actually were used as the basis for a common prioritization that followed that I'll talk a little bit about. There was, I think I mentioned at a public commission meeting in the middle of September, there actually was some overlap. There were areas that both staff and external stakeholders commented on for potential efficiencies. And there were some areas where the staff was much more familiar with what we do internally and how it costs us process-wise. It hadn't been the focus of external comments, but those things do at the end of the day affect our efficiency and our effectiveness, and so they were included in the activities. So having covered the background, things you actually already knew, let me move a little bit into the process. What we did on prioritization and rebaseline process is coming up. Ah, there we go. So this was done in a very structured way. And we started with help and direction from the commission on how they wanted us to look at the work of the agency. And we talk about common prioritization and rebaselining as a single thing. It's actually two tasks that are tied together and were performed in a fully integrated fashion. So common prioritization resulted in us looking at all of our funded activities and thinking about what are the most important and ranking all those activities down through the things that were least important. And the question becomes, well, what is important? And the criteria we use to define importance, which I'll actually go over in a little more detail, stated most simply, were what's our mission? If you go back to our authorizing statutory requirements, our legislation that created the NRC and tasks it, we looked at those sources for our mission. The principles of good regulation, independence as a regulator, clarity of our requirements, openness of what we do, our efficiency, and the reliability of our processes, and then our values, which are largely internal, the things that we do to make sure that we work effectively and well as a team, that also govern how we interact with external stakeholders. So that was the criteria that we used. Once we had ranked all of our work, we then said the reason to do this is that in the future, if we have emergent work that we hadn't planned to do, we want to be able to decide whether the emergent work is more important than something we're already doing, where we have the skill set to do the new work, and what would be displaced. And the reason to do that is it's important that as we displace work, we fully understand the impact of the displacement and that we actually displace work of the lowest priority, not the most important priority. And this is something we've always done, but having a tool that integrates work across the agency makes us much more effective at ensuring that work that comes into one of our offices, one of our internal organizations, isn't simply done by people in that office, that we look across the agency for people with the skills that can do it. Because any given office at any time may be working on some very high priority, very important work, where there may be resources elsewhere working on less important things that make more sense to move when you approach it from a common prioritization perspective rather than a work unit prioritization perspective. So we did that, and when we did it, one of the things the commission had asked us to do was really scrub our processes for efficiency. And we found some efficiencies. The other thing that we challenged ourselves on was we all recognize that there's a point of diminishing return on effort. So in any endeavor, you can, if you paint the inside of your home, you can do a large part of the painting of the bare walls fairly easily. As you mask around all your electrical outlets, all the trim, you can devote increasing amounts of time to the perfection of the paint job. And there's a point of diminishing return where having the line perfect behind your refrigerator isn't as important as having the wall the right color with a uniform coat of high-quality paint. So we really asked ourselves, where are our points of diminishing return where we put additional effort into our activities to gain quality, but that the quality gain really isn't worth the invested effort to get there? It's a difficult thing to do, but that's what we asked ourselves, that's what we challenged our staff for, and I think it was reflected in common prioritization. I'll talk a little bit about how that looks in a minute. And hand in hand with that is the burden that's created when you're in areas of diminishing returns. So we really wanted to focus on decreasing internal burdens with the belief that in doing that, and if we selected the things to focus on well, it would reduce external burden as well. Thank you. So let me go into a little bit of detail about what it looks like, or at least the way it looked when we did this, to take our mission, our values, the principles of good regulation, think about what our authorizing legislation tells us to do. And there are two slides, and I may jump back and forth a little bit, and I apologize, these are very busy slides. But the first most important priority we believe comes from the government is to be able to prevent emergency situations, unsafe situations, and when something happens, to be able to respond appropriately to protect the public and environment. That is our first priority. Then as you look at our statutory basis, we believe that the second highest area of importance, and so this is in the kind of the F column of text, the second block down, are our core activities in establishing safety standards through regulation and supporting guidance and requirements, licensing to those standards, and then performing inspection and investigation to ensure that they're met in operation. For facilities that are either in operation or will be operational in the near term, and when I use the term facility, I mean not only nuclear facilities, but also the use of radioactive materials in medicine and in industry. It also applies to waste disposal and storage. So the full spectrum of things we do where there is a license activity, either ongoing or in the near term, we believe That's the next most important area of focus. And Gina, if you could go to the next slide, I'm going to come back to this one, but I just want to go down the kind of the left, your left column. So the next area of focus is similar to the one I just described. It's core rulemaking, establishment of safety standards, licensing and inspection, but it's for facilities that are not so near term. And we also have statutory requirements for international cooperation, and we license export of certain nuclear technology. And all of those core rulemaking, licensing, and inspection activities, if it's not a currently operating facility or one that will be in the near term, it then went into the third bin on this chart. And then finally, there is everything else, because there's a ton of work that goes on to support the actual rulemaking, the actual licensing, and the actual inspection and enforcement activities. Some of that is in areas that we consider corporate, so the pay of the staff, the facilities that the staff work in. Other parts of it are actually hiring the staff, training and qualifying the staff. Other parts of it are actually developing the programs that we use for licensing, for rulemaking, and for inspection. So all of that we considered support, and we considered it the lowest of our four bins, and it's a very large group because it covers aspects of corporate and direct activities. So, Gene, if we could go back up to the previous slide now, let me talk a little bit about ranking within the bin. So I talked about the concept that there's a point of diminishing return. So even though we bend our work by response to safety conditions, by operating facility, rulemaking, licensing, and inspection, longer term and support, there are legal requirements in each of those areas. And we need to recognize that we can't stop doing something in payroll if there's a law that tells us to do that, or a requirement for IT security, if there's a law that requires us to do that, even though it's not issuing a license or issuing an adequate protection standard. So we said the way we're going to rank within those four bins is to go back to this concept of what are the legal requirements and what's the minimum level of activity to just meet the law. So if the law says once you have established a safety standard for a reactor-powered power plant, then issue a license for an application that demonstrates compliance with that. What would be the minimum amount of effort that we could do to meet that law? And we call that A within the bin. That applies to all four bins. There's a legal requirement for many of the things we do. Then we said, okay, in many cases we do things that either aren't directly required by law, but are necessary to have high confidence in our fulfilling the mission and doing it in a way that's appropriate for the principles of good regulation and our values. So, for instance, there's no law that requires us to use the risk-informed approach to regulation. But a risk-informed approach to regulation is deeply embedded in the principles of good regulation. And so developing guidance and having initiatives for licensing in a risk-informed area, we would consider to be, though not a minimum legal requirement, a very important thing necessary for confidence in our activities. And there's a little bit of language change as you go through the bins in that B ranking, but it all goes back to tie to the mission and legislation, tie to our principles, and tie to our values. Then we challenged ourselves and we said, once you've done your rankings for A and B, then look at everything that's left and challenge why do we do that remaining increment of work? Why do we do that process? Why do we issue that report? Why do we have those outreach activities? Why do we do that training? Why do we develop executives? Not a legal requirement. It's not tied directly necessarily to principles of good regulation, but really scrub all of those things and make sure there's a firm basis that justifies a B ranking within the bin. And if it doesn't, then look at it as a C ranking within the bin. So, little conceptually, it's actually not that hard, but it's a little confusing on the slide because at the end of the day, what we want to do is prioritize. And what we wanted to prioritize was legal mandates in ensuring safety and emergency response. So that was our highest priority one. And then we went down to the next bin, and legal mandates was our second highest priority two. We don't have to go to it, but if we go to the next slide, you'll see legal mandates for bin three was pri three. Legal mandate for support area was pri four. Then we came back up to the first activity bin and said the prudent amount of additional activity in bin one was pri five. Prudent level of effort in bin two was pri six. Similar pri seven, pri eight. Everything in the Charlie bins, rather, whether it was bin one, bin two, bin three, or four, we said is pri 9 and bottom of our common prioritization. So that's essentially what we did in common prioritization. Once we had gone through our work, used this process to place all the work in one of those 9 bins, we then created an internal procedure for emergent work. And our process now requires that if work comes into the agency that we had not planned on performing and isn't included in our budget, we start at priority 9, look for people with the skill to do the new work, and work up our list to pull together the team of people to do the new work until we get to the point where the new work is less important than the work we're doing, and we stop. And we say either we'll do the new work this slowly because of the resources that it takes to do it, or this is when we'll be done because we were able to find enough resources to do it efficiently, and we can identify specifically what will be deferred because of the new work. So that's common prioritization. So I've talked conceptually about that. Let me go to the next slide and give you some illustrative examples of the result of that. So it almost goes without saying that what remained as a high priority was our ability to identify, assess, and respond to unsafe conditions, whether they're safety or security related. Our core statutory functions, rulemaking to establish adequate protection standard remains a very high priority, along with responding to license applications. That's a core agency mission of a high priority. It's higher if it's an operating or near-term facility. It's a little lower if it's a facility in the future or an international mandate, but they're both pretty high priorities. Similar in the inspection arena. The legal mandates that we have to meet as a federal agency are higher priority mandates, whether they're in one of the three areas I just mentioned or if they're in support functions. They're not optional for us. They are high priority. So then on the next slide, it's fair to say, well, okay, that's motherhood and apple pie at the top, what went down to the bottom. So what we found as we looked at work currently planned, we found that there have been fact of life changes, we found efficiencies, we found scope changes, and I'll talk a little bit about some of those generically. So starting with rulemaking, there were actually many suggestions that we received on specific rules that, given the information that's known at the time we asked for the suggestions, it did not appear that individual rulemaking would be an adequate protection rulemaking, and that if you looked at cost-benefit for the rulemaking, it was uncertain or there was actually minimal benefit. And we scrubbed all of our rulemaking activities. I think we've publicly announced several that are being either delayed or are going to be terminated as a result of this review. And there are several others that are low priority at this point that will move into the rebaselining realm. We found that there were fact-of-life changes where, in some cases, work that we had in-house that we've been working on, we finished sooner than expected, not as many as I'd like, but there were cases where we didn't need to continue to devote resources because the work's done or because expected work didn't materialize. There's another kind of fact of life change, and this gets into the scrubbing that we did in looking for diminishing returns and for efficiency. So one of the things that we have done as a prudency measure is we've often planned for the worst case. So an example I would use is reactive and supplemental inspections, which are cases where we respond to a performance problem or an operational event. And we have budgeted to do those at a level where we were very confident that we had trained and qualified inspectors to send out to a reasonable number of simultaneous or sequential events without having a resource hurdle to get over. And it's been our view that that was a prudent approach. When we stepped back and scrubbed that assumption, we concluded that we don't need to have an entire response team be trained and qualified inspectors in a region ready to go to every possible supplemental or reactive inspection, that we, in fact, can supplement inspection staff with people who do other things normally. So whether they're operator examiners in the region, whether they're project managers and technical reviewers in headquarters, whether they're people with previous experience who have moved into other roles, if pressed, we can pull those people in to supplement inspection teams. And if we change our assumption, then we can be more efficient in our resource needs. And that amount became a low priority amount of in-house work available to be displaced in prioritizing. I personally love this one because as a former inspector, the opportunity to go participate in an inspection and get out of headquarters for a while is my dream. I'm looking forward to the day I get a phone call saying, hey, Fred, can you get your safety steel-toed shoes out of the closet and come out and go out to a site? Not because I want there to be a performance issue, but because it's good to be out at the sites periodically. Okay, so efficiencies are within processes. I may have mentioned there are many areas where the staff were able to identify. We do things because the NRC is a very process-driven organization. That will not be surprising to our licensees and the people who represent them. So we build a process and then we follow that process. Like any organization, we do lessons learned when things don't go as well as we want, and we strengthen our processes as a result. And so we find that we have ended up with processes that can be streamlined and right-sized and made more efficient that we believe will not that the changes will bring us back from the point of diminishing return, we can still be effective and efficient.
So there are the part of our processes that's beyond the point of diminishing return is subject to change and to find it. And then a different kind of process, but it looks like an activity, even though it came out of a process review that I'll use for illustrative examples. For those familiar with our reactor oversight process, you'll know that we have a continuous monitoring of licensee performance. It's performed by the resident inspectors and the regional staff that support the resident inspectors. We also, on a quarterly frequency, review performance indicator data from our licensees. And at the branch chief level and inspector level, gather as a group to talk about current performance and do some assessment. In our original process, started in the year 2000, we put a mid-cycle review in that looked very much like a quarterly review but involved more senior regional management. And at the conclusion of that mid-cycle review, we developed a letter that we sent to the licensee documenting the conclusions. And then at the end of the year, we have what we call an end-of-cycle review that also involves senior management as well as inspection staff, and typically counterparts in headquarters. And at that time, we send a letter to the licensee, publicly available documenting performance. When we went back and scrubbed where are there things that cause work, that as we look at that work, it doesn't help advance our core mission, we came up with this particular item, the mid-cycle review, as an example of an area where the administrative burden that goes into supporting the senior manager review that has not produced a result that justifies the activity level. And so that particular mid-cycle review became a low-priority item given our confidence that continuous monitoring, quarterly monitoring, and end-of-cycle monitoring provide 99.99% of the confidence that we have in the reactor oversight. So that's an example of a low priority area. It looks like an action. It's driven by a process review. So what are our next steps? As I said, we've completed the common prioritization review. We've completed our add, shed, defer process to utilize common prioritization. Then we took all of the priority 9 bend activities and scrubbed them to ensure that we had looked at them from an integrated way. Because what I failed to mention was that this was a very much a ground-up activity. So all the suggestions that came in back in the September timeframe were distributed to the subject matter experts who actually work in our offices and our organizations in each area of oversight. And they took those suggestions and their own personal knowledge and populated the priority 1 through 9 list that I described. Management, responsible line managers were involved with that. Ultimately, the office directors finalized the 1 through 9 binning for the work in their offices. We then pulled together about 10 deputy office directors, and we spent way too many hours for 2 weeks, pretty much 2 solid weeks, looking at all the activities across the agency and doing a sanity check from the perspective of not only the office that owned the work, but the offices that... Reprioritized as we felt was necessary for common prioritization. Ultimately, the executive director of operations and the chief financial officer looked at the list and looked at it in a holistic, integrated way and made some final changes. That was all done in early December. Subsequent to that, we started focusing on the priority 9 items. and really doing principles of good regulation and values as criteria, items and activities. Literal. To this month, which will recommend shedding priority 9 or deferring them or performing them with fewer resources. And that's the rebaselining part of the activities that I'm discussing. We want rebaselining to include the critical look that the staff gave it based on the suggestions both from staff and external stakeholders. We also want it to be real. So as we've moved from common prioritization into rebaselining, we've challenged everyone involved. If we decide to stop doing something, are we capable of stopping that now? Can we put the program and procedure changes necessary into place in the near term? Have we thought through the efficiency enough that we can actually define what the efficiency is? Because we want to know what the impact of that efficiency is. It has to be quantified. It can't be, I'll be more efficient. It has to be, I'll be more efficient by X number of hours in a year, by X number of full-time equivalents. We don't want to create a list that looks lovely, but in execution it has no benefit. We want exactly what we're doing and what the impacts will be. Say we, the staff, wants to be in a position to provide to the commission that information for the commission. So into January, that'll be provided to the commission. In early March, hopefully March 1st, there is another deliverable out of this process, and that is some of the things that we found need to be worked on and improved are going to take some re-engineering to be able to define what the end state is and what the realistic efficiency gain. The list of those actions will be provided to the commission with a commitment to work through those as resources are available in the next year or the next 2 years. There's also a commitment to look at known workload changes for the next 4 years. And there are several areas where we know fairly substantial chunks of work are finishing up. We want to be able to capture those, quantify them, and look at the impact of those changes over time. That will come in the end of March, the beginning of March, as well as the early January paper. These documents I expect to be publicly available. The end of January paper, the goal would be to make it available 5 days after it's provided to the commission. The one complication with that involves a recent delay in the submittal of the president's budget to Congress. We're working through how we can structure and write the paper to be able to release it prior to the president's budget going to Congress. Thing we have to work through, but in no case would the paper be released later than when the president's budget for goal would be to do it sooner. We just and the March list should be will be structured in a way where it's fully releasable to the public thereafter, depending on the process. So those are will be major accomplishments for the staff. And then as the commission makes decisions on rebaselining, there'll be major activities for the staff going forward. There are some cases where we've actually stopped things. I mentioned that there are some rulemaking activities that we've already delayed or terminated, and we're communicating those in our normal processes. But in general, at the macro level, a commission asked to be engaged in the final decisions on rebaselining. When those come down, we will continue with implementation. So if I could move to the additional information link, the important thing that I want to communicate is that the execution, the implementation, is actually something that the public can monitor. So if you go to our website, www.nrc.gov, in the left-hand side, there's a spotlight list. Right now, Project AIM is the top link on that spotlight. If you go to that link, one of the things you can directly link to are our monthly updates to the commission for implementation. We are tracking all of the Project AIM activities in those monthly reports. We'll soon be providing them to the Congress on a quarterly basis with some additional information as a result of our appropriation for fiscal year 16. If you have an ongoing interest in monitoring what's going on, you can utilize this link to get direct access to the commission paper on rebaselining when it's available, the March submittal when it's available, and our implementation details. We'll also, at this year's regulatory information conference, have a session on Project AIM and also a comparable or not unrelated initiative within the industry, and we'll have comment from the Union of Concerned Scientists about both of those, at least the Project AIM process and aspect. There will be another commission meeting, I believe, in late March. I don't believe the date's publicly available yet, but it'll be when it's publicly available, it'll be available on the commission's website, list of regulatory activities, and we'll probably try to make sure it's directly available on the And then I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but we are placing Project AIM-related documents in ADAMS as publicly available, so the letters and the emails that we got in September are in ADAMS publicly available. If you're proficient at searching ADAMS and so that was the presentation that I was planning on making. I think the question and answer period is probably as important as anything I said. So if we could move directly to that, Lance.
Sure, I think we can do that, Fred. For those of you in the room, I do have a wireless mic that I can run over to you if you have a question. We need to make sure that everyone is mic'd because we are recording the meeting and so folks on the phone can hear. If you could, whether you're here in the room or on the phones, if you could let us know who you are and any organization that you're with, that'll help us keep track of who's asking questions or making comments today. So, Julie, if you could go ahead and announce to the folks on the phone what they need to do to start a queue. We'll pause for a second.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and you will be prompted to record your first and last name. Please unmute your phone before recording your name. And to withdraw your question, press star 2. One moment.
Okay, while Julie's putting together a queue, let's go ahead and see if we have any questions here in the room. Just get my attention somehow, raise your hand, throw something at me. Okay, got a couple hands here. I'm going to go with Lynn first.
Right, Lynn Farabent with the American Association of Physicists in Medicine. And looking at your priority ranking, I wonder if you could tell me what the definition of near-term is considered in a regulatory or rulemaking process. As an example, AAPM filed a petition for rulemaking in 2006. It was deemed a valid petition in 2006. We still do not have resolution to that petition 10 years later, with Part 35 continually deferred. in our minds from the medical community, it is a high priority item. I think in your overall process, when you compare medical materials rulemaking against the whole gambit of what NRC does, it's never going to surface to the top of the list.
So thank you for the question. So starting with the commission's direction to staff on common prioritization and rebaselining, the basic question, BIN 2 for operating medical facilities has the same binning priority as an operating nuclear power plant or an operating fuel cycle facility or uranium recovery facility or any other type of facility. So for the purposes of this process, it would be BIN 2 if it's an adequate protection rule where there's no existing standard. It would be a 2 alpha. If it's a process improvement, it would be a 2 bravo. It then would go into the rulemaking process. The rulemaking process is an interesting one because in Fred Brown's view, it's in something of a state of transformation or evolution or whatever word you want to use. There's the commission's considering right now policy changes on early commission involvement in rulemaking. Commission's working with the staff on improving the quality of our processes to respond to petitions for rulemaking, how to document them. We right now today have an existing prioritization process for rulemakings that's a little bit different than what I just described. And we literally at 8:30 this meeting, we're 8:30 this morning, we're talking about how we work to go forward to improve our process and bring clarity to our processes and to work with the commission to bring several parallel activities all together. Within Project AIM, a related thing is a request to the commission, a recommendation to the commission to create a center of expertise within the offices for some aspects of rulemaking, which we think could be part of improvement in that area, although there are various ways to look at it, and we have to decide where it fits in the priority of things to look at and work on. Circling back, I fully recognize that doesn't answer the part of your question, which is why haven't you come to closure on a petition for rulemaking from 2006 or whenever that one was. I personally actually don't. I'm not familiar with the rulemaking. I left the medical part of our organization in 2004 or so, so I'll claim that it's been since my time. But.
Well, the root of the question is, what does NRC staff consider the definition of timely action?
And fair question. I can't answer that in the context of I can't answer that in context of a specific question on a rule for you. I think that it's we have to implement our processes to get to a effective answer, a high-quality answer, and 2006 seems like a very long time for a rule, but I can't provide you any more feedback.
And the second question I had is, what's your definition of a near-term licensing action?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So the near term goes back to the difference between BIN 2 and BIN 3. And it's actually not the licensing action that we are concerned about with the near term. It's the tie to an ongoing activity. So if a facility is in operation or it will be in operation in the near term, that's BIN 2. If the facility will not be in operation for several years, that would be BIN 3. So the easiest example is that if an applicant for a a facility to provide diagnostic nuclear medicine material came in, and the applicant said, we are going to build this facility as soon as you license it, and we will operate it in a near term. That would be Bintu. If a nuclear licensee applicant came in and said, we'd like an early site permit within your process for a facility that will be built when the economics are right, that would be Bin 3.
John Butler, NEI. Fred, first off, I'd like to express my appreciation for the efforts of the agency to, first off, do this Project AIM effort, but your efforts to make the processes and activities as transparent as possible and have meetings with various stakeholders. So I do appreciate that. In your discussion of the common prioritization activity, I have a better understanding of what will be done going forward and in the rebaselining. I appreciate your efforts to incorporate process efficiencies. My question is on the common prioritization going forward, how will those process efficiencies be addressed? And I'll use your example of painting a kitchen. You may identify painting a kitchen as a priority one activity, and it will, you know, get some priority and be funded and move forward. At what point are you going to assess whether or not the processes you employ to paint that kitchen really require you to get the line straight behind the refrigerator, which would be a process efficiency for that priority one item? And if that's not done going forward, we're going to eventually find ourselves in a need to implement Project AIM 2040.
Thank you, John. Let me answer, I believe, the question, and I'll circle back to you to make sure I got all of it. There may be two pieces. So the first piece is, in some cases, we're implementing the process to check on the line behind the refrigerator right now. In other cases, we're going to implement that process as soon as we have the commission's approval to revise our procedures to include that process. And that's why I said it's really important to us that what we promise is something that we understand what we're promising and that we can execute it and we can demonstrate that we did it and that it's quantifiable. All of those are key pieces of how we're approaching AIM and are utilizing AIM to build credibility and trust as a desired outcome, and not to overpromise and not to promise things we don't intend to do. So that's a piece of it. The other piece I think that you're asking is, going forward, as we engineer processes, as we start new activities, what do we do to maintain a focus on efficiency consistent with the principles of good regulation? So that's a great question. Project AIM is intended at its heart to be a transformational act. God, I really said that, didn't I? I stood in front of a group of people and talked about transformation. So Project AIM is intended to be a cultural change for us that transforms us from where we are today to an organization that ingrained in our people and how we think is that question of, is what we're doing efficient? Let's go back to our principles and regularly challenge ourselves in those areas. It's a task within AIM. It's a philosophy within AIM. It's not just rebaselining and common prioritization. I'm laughing at myself over words like transformational because, you know, I think many of us, our eyes roll when we hear things like that. But fundamentally, if you talk to the steering committee, the senior leaders of the agency, who I get a chance to talk to way too often as they help steer me in this journey, that is what they tell me. That's what they want to achieve. I think the commission wants us to achieve that. I hope that answers.
Well, I understand your response, Mike. Unless it's made part of the process, I'm not sure that transformation will occur, or if it does occur, will it stick. I mean, my concern at its base level is too often there are new activities that the industry has to deal with where there is an evaluation, a step in the process that says, have you looked at alternative means to achieve compliance or whatever? And the write-ups generally say our alternatives are to do it or not to do it. And we've evaluated that, and we've decided to do it. There hasn't been a critical evaluation of the manner in which, you know, the staff is proposing to do a process to ensure that it's done in the most efficient way. And if that's not part of the process, I encourage you to maybe look at making it part of the process.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the follow-up. So I said we're a rule-based, process-driven organization. Part of what we're doing is revising our processes in areas where we identify potential efficiency gains. I believe that part of what you're referring to is rulemaking activities, in part, and that's an example where we're, as I mentioned, going to have significant changes. And there are many things going on in parallel in the agency, some managed through AIM and in my implementation plan and in my monthly updates, other things not. But the theme that you just described is fully consistent with a lot of activities in the rulemaking area. And the concept for that, I think, rolls into other programs as well. And that's having a culture where all our programmatic processes capture that kind of sensitivity is the culture change that I was referring to. So I believe that I understand your fundamental point and can say with confidence that it's not misaligned with what we're attempting to do. And I think it's also important to say that if you just look at Project AIM and the implementation plan, you will see parts of it, but you would certainly be able to say, hey, there's a need for this in an area that I don't see an implementation plan for. And my feedback would be that's true, but it doesn't mean we're not working on it. There's a lot of moving pieces going on right now.
You want to go to the phone?
Julie, can we see, assuming we might have some questions from the phone?
We do have some questions from the phone. Our first question comes from Tony Leshinsky. Your line is open, sir.
Hi there. Just a couple of things. I'm Tony Leshinsky. I am the state nuclear engineer for the state of Vermont. During the actual presentation towards the end, just so you folks are aware, I believe the microphone started cutting out, so there were sections towards the end of the presentation that I could not hear at all, and it appeared to be more on your end because things would fade out and then go blank for, say, 30 seconds or so. So maybe my question was covered and I simply didn't hear it. The process that has been described in the presentation, first of all, I think it is a very good process for prioritizing. And, you know, case in point, the example of reducing the upper management involvement in the mid-cycle reviews, I think, you know, lends itself to say that, okay, the process that has been developed so far is beneficial to what the NRC is trying to do here and will result in a better use of resources. But what I don't see in this process right now, and you know, maybe you can comment on this now, is that I don't see anything in the process that has been set up so far that really talks about prioritizing individual engineering disciplines. And what I mean by an engineering discipline is, okay, you have two tasks that are categorized as being a high priority. One is in reactor oversight. So reactor oversight is one of the engineering disciplines, but also realize you have other engineering disciplines. Medical medical research, radiological medicine oversight was listed as another. My major concern is reactor decommissioning. So how will the NRC prioritize the disciplines? I'm going to assume that reactor oversight will be given the highest priority simply because there are, in the neighborhood of 100 operating nuclear power plants in the United States right now, whereas there are 5 power plants that are undergoing a decommissioning right now. So I would see that, okay, oversight process will trump everything. But I think you still need to have a process of selecting these priorities. Otherwise, the lower priorities are going to creep up on you, much like reactor decommissioning rulemaking did, that it was considered a medium or a low priority for roughly a decade, and then all of a sudden you needed to do something about it. And I think an important part of this process is to assure that those types of issues do not occur in the future.
Yeah, great comment and question, Tony. And I apologize, it was me and the speaker. I think I crossed my arms and that impacted the lapel speaker that I'm using. So I can give you a little bit of assurance for a narrow piece of this, and then a little bit of process going forward, and then a little bit of I think you're right. So in the near term, one product at the end of January that I did not describe, but that is part of the notation vote paper going to the commission, will be a ranking of all of the currently funded rulemaking activities against the criteria, the ranking and binning that I just described.
Okay.
And so I believe that you can look forward with interest to what happens to a decommissioning rule where that decommissioning activity is near term and how it changes its relative ranking on a current list. So that's the near term piece. The midterm piece goes back to my discussion, which may have cut out, that rulemaking in general is an area that deserves our refocus. We recognize that. The common prioritization approach that takes a high-interest rulemaking activity, if there are active decommissioning sites, and moves it down to low and may advance other things, I think that's a good discussion that's going to be ongoing. I don't know the outcome of that yet. And then the final piece, I think is a good comment that I can't say anything more about, is there are whether it's a medical rule, PRM, a petition for rulemaking from any of our stakeholder community, having a culture and a process where we can reach timely conclusions and where a final rule is the right timely conclusion, that we focus on doing that and not allowing things to backlog, I think goes more to that cultural piece that I was talking about. That we recognize, we know we need to work on it, we're committed to do that, but I can't point to a specific process deliverable necessarily for you.
Okay. I do have one follow-up.
Okay, Tony, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to be paraphrasing this. My first question was based on notes I had made during the presentation. This one I did not get a chance to make notes. In the specific example of reducing the upper management involvement in the mid-cycle reviews of the ROP process, realize that part of the reason, I think anyway, not having more information on it. You know, one of the reasons that you can do that is that the day-to-day process in the you know, the resident inspectors program is very robust. So you know, I would see that based on that robustness, yeah, you can take this this additional oversight item and reduce its importance. But another thing to consider is what happens if, you know, for whatever reason, budget cuts, lack of manpower, whatever, that some of your other, some of the other processes that allow you to make some of these items lower priority, if they degrade for whatever reason, do you have a mechanism in place to assure that, say, increased involvement by management in this example could be reinstated if it was warranted at a later date?
Yep, great question. Thank you, Tony. So there's kind of two aspects of that, actually, let me touch on briefly. On the specifics of the reactor oversight process assessment of our process, we do every year do a self-assessment and look at, are we in the right place? And if we found that we were missing things, we would go back and make the change or a change to address the effect of something like a little less focus on senior management review in the mid-cycle reviews. And to be honest, I should have characterized that change a little bit better. It actually won't be that senior managers won't keep abreast of activities. It's that we're actually reducing the administrative process of producing paper for senior managers specifically to review, because we need simple paper, and also reducing by one the letters we send to licensees. I think the other piece of that I heard in your comment question was the cumulative effect of changes, and it applies both to small changes which all add up to get unrecognized burdens or inefficiencies built into the process, and it can also it can manifest itself in a time of change in making small changes and creating a deleterious effect that wasn't recognized. And we're sensitive to both of those. The commission's sensitive to both of those. And part of the reason that the paper going up at the end of this month will include all of the near-term changes is to reduce the potential to trickle a bunch of changes to the commission where we missed a cumulative impact on the effectiveness of our regulatory program. If we could maybe go to one more question on the phone back before coming back to the room.
Sure. Julie, can we go to the next person in the queue?
Certainly. We have a question from Bob Link. Your line is open, sir.
Thank you. This is Bob Link. A comment and one question. One, I think you spoke to the importance already of the identifying process improvements to truly have long-term efficiencies and more effective means. But I was afraid in the presentation it came across, at least to me, that the emphasis was more task oriented versus trying to identify those key processes that truly have some inefficiencies or lack of effectiveness built in them today, and how that fits into your prioritization scheme. The scheme seemed focused on tasks or programs or methods, but not necessarily on improvement and process. That's a comment. The other question, though, I have is how I recognize in your, where you go from here, the next steps, but I'm interested in a little more detail on how you anticipate involving stakeholders in this ongoing process. So if you make recommendations, for instance, to the commission to delete or defer or, significantly alter a different task or issue or means, how do you anticipate to have stakeholder continue to have involved in those recommendations and decisions? Thank you.
Great question. Thanks. And so, looking at process was intrinsic to what we asked external stakeholders and internal stakeholders to do. So there were many processes where we then identified specific changes to revise the process. Part of this can be in terms of what level of process are we talking about. So I think that moves to the maybe a second aspect of your question, which is, would we undertake a dramatic reworking of a major process like the rulemaking process? It's got a specific legal requirements and adjudicatory requirements. Was that part of common prioritization and rebaselining? And the answer actually is no. So there may be cases, like I've talked about rulemaking, where we need to improve our process to have a better prioritization and scheme for today, but that would not affect going back and changing a petition for a 2206 process or a 2.208 process within our regulations. Those would be somewhat out of scope. And it is important to say I appreciate the question because it allows me to reinforce that openness is a principle of good regulation, and it's also one of our values. And so we are respectful of that. Any recommendation that were to be approved by the commission for a change, those changes will be implemented in accordance with our legal processes for change. So if we did recommend a change to something that, like rulemaking, then we would work through a rulemaking process for our 10 CFR Part 2 for rulemaking. So many of the changes are internal. There are internal procedures and process. We would not go out and seek public comment on those changes. But if there's something that's fundamental to a principle of good regulation like openness, I think off the cuff that that's going to take us through a process where there would be opportunity for continued engagement. So maybe back, you want to?
Yeah, let's just take a check just to see if anybody in the room has any questions before we go back to the phones.
John Butler, NEI again. Fred, I think, did I hear right that you're, one of the things is going to be issued, I guess, January or either March, is going to be a ranking of the currently funded rulemaking activities?
Yes, the end of January. Part of what the commission asked us to do this summer when we were developing the guidance and criteria for doing common prioritization in rulemaking was they asked us to specifically look at currently funded rules and let them know how each of those rules individually would fall out under the common prioritization scheme that I ran through with the bins and rinks. So that is a product that is going to the commission the end of January. It will be publicly.
That leads to this question. I mean, is there any effort underway to incorporate any of the aspects of the common prioritization process you discussed here into what is referred to as the CPR, common prioritization of rulemaking process? They are two very different processes, will give very different results.
Yep, and so when I was mumbling into my arm or shoulder about a meeting at 8:30 this morning where we asked ourselves, how do we bring together the common prioritization criteria and the existing rulemaking common prioritization process and the commission's early engagement in rulemaking and increased quality and hopefully timeliness in our responses to petitions for rulemaking, that's what I was talking about. And so that's a broad area of activity that goes beyond these tasks, but it's an activity not within Project AIM even necessarily, but it's this kind of thing we're doing now as an agency.
Schedule-wise, are you targeting to have something for the commission to discuss with the commission by March or
no?
So later, earlier?
So this morning we were talking about the need to do this and develop an action plan. So I don't have an action plan yet to be able to share a date, and we'd certainly work that with the commission before we made any public announcement on it. I guess shouldn't have said anything other than I wanted to kind of convey how the agency is attempting to take the culture change of Project AIM and not make this just a, you know, work through an implementation plan and a checklist, be done, wash our hands, and move on the way business as usual.
Excuse me, Annie Caputo with Senate Energy Committee. You noted in your slides list of long-term process improvements for 2018 and beyond. I guess my question is, if the agency is becoming smaller, shouldn't you front-end load those process improvements? So as the agency becomes leaner, those efficiency benefits are already enshrined and benefiting the workforce.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. What I was trying to, yes, we should, and we intend to. We don't intend not to. The reason that I refer to 2018 and beyond is for the ones that are the longer term, the activity to get to the point where we could define the end state and quantify the savings, those are 6-month activities, and they're going to stack up, and just doing our changes in the near term that are on the recommended rebaselining list mean that you won't see results into 2018 and beyond. And your fundamental point about do we need to think about whether we're retaining the capacity to do this in an aggressive way going forward and not let these linger, I think is a fair question. It's to some extent a policy question. I personally believe, even at that, with the size of an agency that we have, if we use people wisely and implement these business process changes intelligently, that we will have the capacity to do it. And it's a change management issue of biting off a bite that we can swallow and work it effectively. So if we had a drastic reassignment of folks in the near term to do all these so we could try to be done in 6 months, we'd run the risk of unintended impact on our core licensing, rulemaking, and inspection activities that we want to avoid. And I'd have much less confidence that we could do it well. So we want to, you know, we're balancing doing it as quickly as we can so we don't have unrealized gains, being realistic in how quickly we can change our procedures and processes and the availability of resources to do the initiatives, and it is a balancing act. And getting done as quickly as we can is important. And please don't take my 2018 date as a we're not doing anything till 2018. It's just that I think this subsequent list in terms of realistic scheduling, that you're not going to start this. We won't be able to achieve many of the balances until that kind of time frame. We're not waiting, but I think that's kind of how I think about realistic.
So 2018 is the year that you expect to see the benefits, not implement the process.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the clarifying question. So what we're going to tell the commission on the longer term items is that the benefits will start accruing 18 months or so out as we work through these systematically between now and then, starting with the changes in rebaselining and progressing through the longer term activity. And it's not a waterfall, it's a cascade. It's working through sequentially initiatives to continue to improve.
Okay, if we could go to the phone and take a few callers, and then I have a few more here. Julie?
Yes, our next question comes from Ace Hoffman. So if you could please announce your organization.
Hi, this is Ace Hoffman, and I'm a citizen. I have a comment to make. We were talking earlier about openness of these hearings, and I think there's a secondary problem, which is the amount of proprietary information that is required for safety that is not available to the public, and sometimes it's available to you, and I'm not sure that it's even always available to you, but it's definitely not available to the public or to experts outside of the NRC or the industry. So in this process, I'd like to see some sort of standard be set up so that you can balance the need for public safety against these proprietary claims, because an example here near where I live is the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station's steam generator failure. We have not been able to pry the flow rates of the primary coolant and secondary coolant, and without those numbers, it's almost impossible to figure out what went wrong. And I cannot imagine what use that information is. That's what broke the reactor were those numbers, and the public and the industry needs to know what was going on. So I'd like to see some effort made to relax some of the proprietary information standards. And one more comment on the decommissioning, which is, of course, going on thanks to these failures. I feel that the NRC is letting go of the ropes to a large extent, and the amount of fuel there is enough to destroy Southern California. So you need to hold on to it much more tightly. So I'd like to echo the comments from the Vermont representative on that issue, that you mustn't do that. Thank you very much for taking my call and for holding this hearing.
Thank you, Ace. I respect the comments and appreciate them. I would just offer that we do have access to any information that we need to make a safety determination, or we wouldn't draw a conclusion if we didn't have the information. But otherwise, I respect your view.
Yes. Julie, can we go to the next caller, please?
Yes. Our next question comes from Dave Crawley. So if you could please announce your organization. Thank you.
Hi. It's Dave Crawley from North Carolina's Radioactive Materials Program. I just got the slides from Monica Ford, so thanks for that, Monica. Looking at these bend priorities that were in the presentation being discussed here, they're very generic at this point. And you mentioned earlier on that you had nearly 400 some comments and feedback of different items that could stand for process improvements and different things of that nature. Once the NRC determines which items or which things are going to be changed and in what way they're going to be changed, and there might be some summarization of these at this time, but once that happens, maybe a table of these different priority bins and the specific items that are going to be within them and the proposed changes to those items, I think that would be helpful to the stakeholders, both from the licensee standpoint and public and other regulatory agencies. Specifically, I think we talked about rulemaking process earlier, but I wanted to make sure that, sticking with the analogy, that the paint on the wall isn't deemed good enough at this point, and that we're not going to continue looking at maybe the rulemaking process, or in my interest, since we use WBL in North Carolina, that it's considered a developed tool, a finished product, that it's going to be low on the priority as a result. I think we're trying to get a lot of other states in on that program. So once these different bins and items are all set and prioritized, some sort of summary document detailing what those process improvements will be so that the stakeholders can then give feedback on those items. So more of a comment than a question, but that's all. Thanks.
Okay. So thank you, Dave, for that. And actually, so it's an opportunity for me to clarify. So any recommended change to process will be publicly available in the paper the end of January, and the Commission's decision will be publicly available, and we will then work through those through our normal processes. Rulemaking and the prioritization of rules
is a slightly standalone product, and I understand your point. The one thing I don't want to leave anybody thinking in the presentation is that we envision slowing down the change process itself for extensive interaction on many things that are internal procedures and process. Those will be worked through their normal processes. But when you see the list of changes and the commission's actions, I think engagement through your normal communication channels with us to stay abreast of what we're doing and engagement opportunities is a great idea.
Okay, I've got a couple hands here in the room, and then we'll go and try to blow through all the phones. So,
Janet Schleter, NEI. I, too, would like to applaud the agency for taking this initiative under wraps and making a lot of progress. It represents a large cultural change, as you know. It's not an easy one. And the transparent manner in which you've been operating. But as you know, the last couple of months, the visibility that we've had of this effort has pretty much been limited to process discussions, like at the commission briefing and this one today. So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about some of the content of the January paper that might give us a little bit more visibility of how the NRC considered some of the stakeholder input. So on the first bullet, under the commission paper for January, it says the recommended work to be shed for commission consideration. So are the shed items, is there other information related to work that would be slowed down or protracted, or is it limited to that which will be shed?
Right. Thank you, Janet. And thank you, because there was something inherent in, I think, the previous question from Dave that I didn't address. So let me be clear. Common prioritization doesn't change the speed at which we implement work in the agency or tasks. So common prioritization doesn't change the metric for issuance of license amendments or for issuance of ESPs. It's to compare work for ad-shed process. That was, I think, more tied to what Dave said, but your question took me back there. So on the paper in March, the reason that we use the language work to be shed, deprioritized, or funded with fewer resources is that's language the commission used with us in initiating this task. What you will see at the end of January is a discussion in a few cases, not too many actually, of work the way you might think about this means this rulemaking activity is going to be stopped. There are a few of those, but most of what you'll see is we're going to have a process change to eliminate the formal mid-cycle review and letter to the licensee in the reactor oversight process. So you'll see what we're changing in terms of how we work or the requests that we're making to the commission. Is that where you were going with your question, or I'm still missing a piece of it, please?
No, I think that satisfies the question in large part, and obviously we'll read the paper to learn more. So with what you said, I'm assuming that, you received a lot of input from stakeholders last fall. NEI, certainly on behalf of the industry, wrote quite a few letters. So I'm assuming that there are initiatives that you're shedding that are self-identified, that go beyond what you received from stakeholder input. I mean, I would assume that's a natural outcome to expect in the paper. Okay. So as part of that as well, and some of the criteria that you use to bin and make these decisions, on the chart, I didn't see anything referencing staff requirements memorandum or a previous direction to the commission on specific rulemakings or what have you. So was that fair game to go into the sausage making for potentially shedding, slowing down, what have you?
Yes, although we don't use the language sausage making when we refer to the commission, that is slicing a fine roast with a sharp knife. the commission specifically empowered the staff to review previous commission decisions and make recommendations where things had changed, including SRMs or budgeting approval to proceed in budget documents. So the reason that the January paper is a notation vote paper for commission consideration is that we will be asking the commission to make policy decisions in areas that they may have previously made decisions that based on the current facts, the world has changed, and we would recommend a different approach than in the past. The portion of the total recommendations that fit into that, actually can't, I mean, it's not like the paper is entirely that. It's not insignificant, but it's not the majority of the paper.
Right. Okay. Fair game. And then just one statement you don't even have to respond to, but as part of our comments, we had suggested that in the future the staff consider prioritizing its efforts to develop guidance based on the needs of the guidance as determined by the licensees who actually fund their development. So I'm hoping as part of this process, the NRC is considering reaching back to its licensees in order to receive input on the prioritization of future guidance development or revising current guidance, since it's the licensees who are actually using it. You don't have to respond to that.
Yeah, well, I can't help myself, obviously. I haven't taken a comment yet without at least thanking the commenter. So I appreciate the observation, and I accept the part of it that's a comment. Those comments were shared with the line managers in the program offices. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to use the routine monthly and quarterly meetings with each business line to ask about that. One of the areas that I believe is longer term is to look at the reg guide process, the review and revision of reg guides. And I think that that's a sort of process change that will involve coordination as we enter into that. And so I would hope that the business lines are responsive to the input from all stakeholders and you can have a dialogue in the near term. And I actually suspect that in the longer term, that's an area that we're not done. I believe it's not the January paper, but the March information that flags the reg guide process as one that's ripe for review.
Fred, Lynn Farabent with AAPM. Just to follow up on something you just said, and two, I want to echo what NEI has said on the agency having the courage to take on this process. But you made the comment that these changes and all were shared by, I think you used the term, line managers during this process. In the office of NMSS, which has now been recreated again after being split and now back again, new line managers are not even in place. So what's the potential impact on having to revisit this discussion and decisions when the staff changes are implemented?
Okay. So great question. So one of the things that the commission either in individual commissioner votes, which are public on the SRM for SECI 15015, or the SRM itself, I think, and certainly in their meetings with the staff and the public meetings, the commission wanted this process to be one that we could have high confidence in, not just what we do now, but that it come to fruition as described. And so they directed and encouraged us to work through common prioritization and rebaselining utilizing the expertise of subject matter experts and involving the responsible line managers so that we don't start down a path and have it derailed, that when we start down a path, it's well thought out and we can efficiently and effectively complete the journey. An aspect of that is the ownership by the line organizations and their office directors and the executive director of operation, the entire agency management team. And so if there's, because I'm a technocrat or bureaucrat or whatever it is, you could easily assume that when I talk about process, it's just that's what I do. But I do think that it's of interest to our stakeholders that this product is owned by the management team of the agency from top to bottom. And so while there may be changes in an individual organization, the path that we are proceeding on has involved staff input, it's involved line management input, and it's owned by the management team of the agency, and that's been a regular theme over the last couple months of the entire management team. This is our product. We own it. We are going to implement it when the commission makes decisions, and we're not going to propose something to the commission that we can't own and in good faith implement a change.
Okay. Julie, how many people do we have in the queue currently, if you would?
We have no one in the queue at this time.
No one in the queue. Okay. So I guess I will ask if there's any questions either here in the room or on the phones. Any activity, Julie?
I'm showing no questions.
Well, I want to thank everybody again for coming out and listening to me this long. I'm surprised anyone could put up with that for that long. I look forward to getting a paper to the commission at the end of the month. I'm sure there'll be interest in it. I'm sure we'll hear back from interested stakeholders on it. I'm personally confident that it's of high quality and that it's executable and that we'll be able to follow through on those things that the commission intends. And I want to thank everyone that contributed to the process with your suggestions and recommendations in the September timeframe, and thank you for your continued interest, and wish you all a very happy afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.